So, and as a result of that decision, the book ended up being a good 100 pages longer, I'd say, because then everything that happened afterward with Aragorn having to run back to the Varden and Rohan and Katrina flying back to the Varden on Saphira, and all the scenes with Nos Sawada and Rohan at the Varden while Aragorn's returning to the Varden, none of that was originally in the story. So, and that was actually one reason the book ended up getting split into two then, because
this
it got
episode
so long.
Was added.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's actually one of my favorite parts of the book. And one of the things I love about it is I feel like it really is a moment where Aragorn is struggling with his role as a leader that he's pretty newly in still, and discovering what that means and what his own limitations are, which is a really interesting part of that interaction between them.
Thank you. That's actually something I think that's a big theme in this book, is there are a lot of the characters are struggling with how to lead properly. Mm-hmm. We see Nos Sawada really dealing with some more of the problems that come with leading the Varden, and Rohan as well is becoming sort of assuming a position of greater authority within the Varden, and he's presented with a number of difficult choices with how to do that and how to lead the men that he's given command over, and also how to obey orders as well. And even Saphira has a few choices like that, I think.
Do you have a favorite character from the cycle?
That's a difficult question. I'm very fond of Angela because she's based on my sister, of course, Angela. But she's not really a true character in that sense. She's more like an exaggerated version of my sister. I'm very fond of Nos Sawada and Aragorn, of course, and Arya. But probably Saphira is my favorite character. I've said that before, but it's the truth.
How could it be any other way?
In fact, that's one of the things I really love about Brisinger, was getting a chance to write a few chapters from Saphira's point of view.
And I wanted to ask you about that. How did you decide to go about capturing her point of view? You do it so beautifully. It's such a unique and even non-human view of the world that you capture in those chapters. How did that come about?
I was a little uncertain about how to tackle it at first. I thought it was going to be a big problem, and I knew that I had to do it right or not at all, because she is such an integral part of the series. You know, if I messed up chapters from her point of view, it's kind of like, well, why even do them then? But it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, because I've spent so many years now writing dialogue from her point, not from her point of view, but writing dialogue of hers in Aragorn's mind. And I had sort of constructed a certain mindset of my own that when I went to write a piece of Saphira's dialogue, I think, okay, this is how she thinks. This is how she's going to react to the situation. And oftentimes her reaction isn't the way anyone else would react. You know, it's a bit of an unusual reaction. So when I went to write her point of view, I already had sort of a framework for the way her thoughts and her dialogue would work. And I just started to try to build on that, okay? How would she react to everything else? How would she observe everything else? I think the biggest unique thing I did with her point of view was the way she and other dragons view things with chains of association, I guess, you know, where she won't look at something and say, oh, that's a campfire. She'll look at that and say, well, that's a campfire that smells smoky, that burns and bites and flickers. And she doesn't think of a name necessarily. She thinks of all the associations with an item. And that's actually a holdover from my idea, from when the dragons were a wild race, because at least within the mythology of my world, they never invented a language of their own. The way they communicated was through telepathy and through these connections, if you will, these associations. And it's still how dragons think to this day, even though now they have the structure of language to provide a framework for those associations. So Saphira doesn't always use words, you know, sometimes it's feelings or sense or stuff like that. And that's what I was trying to convey as well. And of course, growing up with a dog and cats in the house helped a great deal when writing about a dragon.
Yeah. I had those moments of connecting Saphira with animals that I know in my own life too.
Mm-hmm.
Just especially descriptions of her movement or a certain look in her eyes that felt, although dragons are these mythical creatures, felt so authentically alive.
Well, it's a bit of a cliche to sort of base a dragon on a cat, but I think dragons are very feline. But at the same time, watching our family's dog, Annie, as I was growing up and bringing her up, she also, I think, brings some elements to Saphira, or provided with me with some observations that I was able to use with Saphira. Like, sometimes the way Saphira moves or pounces around reminds me of Annie.
Yeah, that sense of playfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, cats don't really, I mean, cats do play, but when they play, they're still serious.
Yes.
You know, they're still a whisker's breadth away from actually killing something. whereas a dog will actually play and enjoy it.
Yeah, real joy there.
Mm-hmm.
How has your home state of Montana shaped the inheritance cycle?
Oh boy. As I've said in other interviews, I think I might have still written fantasy if I had grown up somewhere other than where I did, but growing up in Montana really filled me with a love for the outdoors and the mountains especially. You know, you've visited.
It's spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, the view of the mountains is just awesome, and looking at them every day just gives me constant inspiration. And also getting to watch the wildlife. Watching the animals interact gives me more of a feeling for how Saphira would act, maybe. And also, I think, more of a feeling for how the world works outside of humans as well.
Does the sheer physical beauty of your environment, because it truly is spectacular out there, breathtaking, sustain you as a writer?
Oh, it does. And in fact, whenever I visit other locations that are beautiful as well, they inspire me as well. It's, again, it's not that a writer can't write in a gray concrete block or something.
Like New York, perchance.
Well, New York's a lot more colorful than that. But I do think having beautiful things around you and having inspiring things around you makes a big difference for a writer, especially when you're writing something that's set in the natural world with incredible, fantastical features. Seeing some of those very things in your own life definitely helps. And also, I can't speak for other writers, but as for myself, I sometimes can't think of the little details that you only learn by actually going out and feeling something or looking at something or experiencing something yourself. There's just no way to find that information unless you do it yourself.
How would you describe your writing process?
I don't know. How would you describe it?
Turning it back around on me. Well, I'd say it's a very intensive experience that you really live and breathe these characters in this story and these books, and you immerse yourself 110% from the moment you dive in.
Yeah, intensive. That's the word. From the moment I begin a book, I sort of enter, my life enters suspended animation for a year and a half, 2 years. I'm not the fastest writer most of the time, and I write big books. So I have to really, really buckle down and focus every single day if I'm going to get a book done in a semi-timely fashion. and part of the problem is sometimes, no matter how much I plan and try to work things out beforehand, the story ends up surprising me, as Brissinger did, where it just ended up a lot longer than I had thought. And that, of course, ends up putting on certain pressures with regards to the deadline and stuff. But, I mean, as far as the day-to-day process goes, you know, I get up, I grab breakfast, I sit in front of the computer, and I usually work straight through till about an hour before dinner when I get up to exercise and go watch a movie with my parents.
A full day of writing.
It is. And it's weird because as a career, this is definitely a career of extremes. You know, one day I'll be sitting at my desk, not having left the house for a month, and the next day I'm, you know, talking in front of a crowd somewhere, and it's a real switch. And I've, both elements of the process require different skills, and I've known some writers who have excelled at both, and I've known some writers who excel at one and don't excel at the other, and they don't necessarily go hand in hand, you know, doing the sort of the promotion and public relations aspect of a writer's life with the writing. And it's something that you have to, it helps to keep separate from, it helps me to keep the two separate, actually. So I don't write when I'm out and traveling, and I don't do talks and stuff when I'm at home.
That makes sense.
Actually, it's funny because when I write, I'm not even aware of this sometimes, but I say things out loud oftentimes, trying out the sound of the words or the way a sentence is.
Sure.
When my sister and I used to have rooms very close together in an the house we grew up in, and she used to get so annoyed with me because she could hear me talking.
Aloud.
Talking aloud, reading the sentences out loud. And I remember she'd come and say, you know, stop doing that! Be quiet! I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm not doing anything.
And you didn't even notice you were doing
it. No, no. But now I have my own space to work in, and it's, I can talk as much as I like.
One thing that I really loved as watching these books progress and watching these characters develop is how Aragorn and Rohan are each really coming into their own. So what do you think is the biggest character difference between Aragorn and Rohan?
Rohan.
We'll be doing that back and forth for another few years.
Yeah. Well, we can tackle the question about the pronunciation in a second, but as far as the characters go, Aragorn worries about things. Rohan worries about certain things. Rohan worries about the people he cares about. Katrina, his friends from Carvajal, the people he serves under, and the people he commands eventually in Brisinger. But that's pretty much where his concerns end. He doesn't really worry about the land as a whole. I mean, he thinks about it occasionally, but his concerns are very personal. And he is decisive in a way that Aragorn isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's put it this way. If Katrina's in danger, he'll say to himself, Rohan will say to himself, okay, I'm going to go over there and rescue Katrina. And that's it. He goes and he does it. And it doesn't matter what's in his way, he goes and he does it. Even if it were to kill him, he would go and try to rescue her.
He's not a hand-wringer.
No. Whereas Aragorn, if he saw, for example, Arya was in danger, he's going to look at her and say, okay, I'm going to go rescue Arya. And let's see, I have to run this way and run that way, and I have to, you know, chop off this guy's head, but he's kind of turning to flee, so maybe I should just let him go. And this other guy, well, maybe I shouldn't really kill him, but maybe I can just cripple him instead.
And he spends a long time in his head and in the process, mm-hmm. and Rohan is really active.
Part of that is the fact that Aragorn has to use magic, and magic means that you really have to think about the consequences of your words and your actions, because if you say the wrong thing, you could not only kill people you care about, but you could kill yourself. And of course, Aragorn has been saddled with responsibilities far larger than those of Rohan's. When I was originally plotting out the series, I actually envisioned it as the story of three pseudo-brothers, I guess you could call it.
Hmm.
We had Aragorn, we had Murtagh, and we had Rohan. And they don't all get equal screen time. Aragorn gets the most, of course, and Rohan ends up getting the second most. In fact, when I was writing Aragorn, I actually debated at one point having Rohan accompany Aragorn from Carvajal all the way up to when he and Brom go to Tirm, and then having Rohan go back to Carvajal at that point. But didn't work out with the story, but I've always envisioned it as a sort of, you know, the story of these three half-brothers, if you will. And that's actually something like in the fourth book, we'll be seeing more of Murtagh then.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to that.
Wait, you know, equal out the balance here.
Well, he is an intriguing character.
We haven't seen much of him in the middle two books. And, of course, we really can't because he's fighting against Aragorn and the Varden now. But we'll see a lot more of him in the fourth book. And I think readers will get to know him a little bit better, and especially, hopefully they'll understand the situation he's been forced to deal with now a little bit better.
Have a little bit of sympathy, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a bad person. He's just been raised in a difficult environment and then stuck in an impossible situation.
Now, he and Aragorn have both become very strong over the course of these past couple of books. And have you ever found yourself kind of written into a corner in terms of magic?
Well, I have written scenes where I write it the way I want to write it, the way I originally envisioned it. And 2 weeks later, when I'm working on a different chapter, I'll suddenly think, wait a minute, why didn't he do this? Why didn't he just use this or that? Like when, for example, in Brisinger, when Aragorn and Murtagh fight.
Right.
One of the questions was, well, why wouldn't Aragorn use the energy that's in the ring that he got from Brom?
Right.
And those questions have to be answered, because when I was growing up and I was reading a lot of fantasy at a certain point, I remember having lots of questions like that myself. And I won't name books here, but there were plenty of occasions where you had characters who could use magic, and I'd say, well, you know, okay, they're in a fight, they're in this difficult situation, why doesn't he just cast a spell to get him out of it? One way authors have gotten around this, and something that I think I might do in the future, is to set up a more limited system of magic. Mm-hmm. Something that only works under certain circumstances, or that's much more limited in terms of power or strength, that just isn't as flexible, can't be used for as wide a range of circumstances.
Right.
That's one of the nice contrasts between Aragorn and Rohan. You know, Rohan has to fight his way out of any situation, pretty much. He has to just rely on his own body and his brute strength. Whereas Aragorn, you know, he can pretty much get out of most any situation at this point. However, he has to become this powerful if he's to have even a slight fighting chance against Murtagh. And we're not even going to mention Galbatorix here, because he's still not as powerful as Galbatorix.
Right, he's still working on getting that fighting chance against Galbatorix.
Yeah. And on one hand, it's almost like a superhero story, where we have Aragorn gradually becoming more than human. You know, now he's sort of half-elf, half-human, mm-hmm. and he has all this incredible power. And the question is, how do you keep the character real at that point? Part of it is giving him emotional problems instead of just physical problems.
Sure. And it is quite a burden on him, this entire battle. So there's certainly a lot of emotional heft to his life, just based on the circumstances
yeah.
that he finds himself in.
And of course, the other half of the solution is giving him more and more dangerous enemies.
He has that as well. Do you have a favorite scene in Brisinger, or a scene that was a favorite scene to write?
Oh boy. I think I have a number of favorite scenes throughout the book. I like the scene where Saphira fuses or heals the star sapphire among the dwarves. I love the scene where Aragorn and Arya are sitting around the campfire and Arya makes the grass ship that flies off into the night.
Beautiful.
All the scenes between Rohan and Katrina in their tent late at night were special favorites of mine. I loved writing those. I think that they just really have a connection none of the other characters really share.
I love those scenes too. They felt really intimate and connected to me.
Well, and one of the nice things about their relationship is that when the series begins and when we first start seeing scenes from Rohan's point of view in Eldest, he's already courted Katrina. He's already won Katrina, and we don't need to see them going through that. They already have a relationship. Of course, when he rescues her, then in this book, it's just sort of a confirmation of what they both already knew. So I get to show sort of a different kind of relationship with them than exists between, say, Aragorn and Arya, who are just sort of dancing around each other.
Right. Yeah, you really feel the history between Rohan and Katrina.
And actually, I don't want to embarrass them here too much, but Rohan and Katrina's relationship is really based on my parents.
Wow.
I've seen them share sort of moments like that. I mean, they trust each other implicitly. Actually, a lot of Rohan is based on my dad, to be honest. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if ever anything had ever happened to my mom, he would have crossed the country and done who knows what to get her back. So, you know, write what you know.
That's right. Well, I think that's a huge compliment to them. I'm sure they're honored to be that inspiration.
Well, I just hope that someday I'll have a marriage that lives up to theirs. Let's put it that way.
One of my favorite scenes, switching to relationship that was not as strong as we could cast back from the story from Eldest, is the scene with the Manoa tree.
Oh, yes.
I love that scene. It's so powerful, and it just draws you in, and you cannot take your eye from the page until the destiny behind that scene has unfolded. How did you do that?
I don't know. It was just a series of questions, you know, asking what happens next, what needs to happen next. Aragorn needed to find the ore, the bright steel, and, you know, he can't dig under the tree, so, and the tree's alive, so it seemed natural that he and Saphira would talk to the tree, and it seemed also natural that a gigantic, well, certainly a tree that large, isn't going to pay the slightest attention to two little gnats running around its trunk. So, and Saphira, despite all her wisdom and advantages, Saphira is not patient.
That's so.
I mean, on one hand, dragons are patient, but Saphira's a young dragon, and Saphira is not patient.
And that certainly plays a role in their interaction with the slow-moving consciousness of the tree.
Yes, and when the tree starts reacting in a hostile manner, I was sort of thinking about times when I've been out hiking in the forest and a wind has sprung up and you hear the branches, and especially the dead branches, rubbing against each other, and the whole forest creaks and groans and sways, and it's very ominous. I mean, it feels threatening. And sometimes you'll even hear a tree crashing down somewhere in the forest, and it can actually feel as if the whole forest wants you gone, or that there's something very strange heading toward you, strange and dangerous. And I was thinking of that when I was writing the Manoa tree's reaction, of the whole forest sort of coming alive and going after Aragorn and Saphira. And if the Manoa tree had, you know, wanted to do them in, let's just say Aragorn and Saphira's chances would be...
minuscule?
-2.
If we had to quantify.
Yeah, not good in the slightest. I mean, you can be as strong as you want. You're not as strong as a forest.
That's very true. That is such a grand force as compared to the individual force of all of these characters mm-hmm. moving through the world.
Well, one of the strange things or unusual things as far as the forest in that section of Duveldenvarden is that it's a pine wood forest. It's a pine tree forest, which most elf forests that you see in fantasy, so to speak, tend to be broadleaf forests, you know, oak trees and more invented trees, but they tend to be leafy trees, not evergreens. And I made it a pinewood forest because I've seen some of the forests on the west coast.
Sure.
Like Oregon and then heading up toward Alaska, where it's almost like a rainforest. Well, it is a rainforest, actually, but it is a pine forest, it is an evergreen forest, but you still get a lush feeling from it. But you also get kind of a cliche to say this about a needled tree, but you get a spiky feeling from the forest. and I kind of wanted that for the elves, and also with their language. You know, I wanted a bit of a harder feel for my elves, just because I think sometimes there's a tendency to forget that the elves can be very, very, very dangerous.
I don't think you let us forget that. The elves can be very dangerous, from watching Arya kill an animal to put it out of its misery mm-hmm. to Islanzadi's assessment of various situations. They're also very decisive, very clear-cut, and not afraid to take action.
Well, Islanzadi is an odd character. I always kind of think of her as an opera singer in one way. She's very dramatic.
She is dramatic.
I've always thought that's actually part of the problem between her and Arya, that Islanzadi is prone to being controlling and certainly for an elf being over-emotional from an elf's standpoint. And she's very, I mean, like the first scene between Arya and Islanzadi, when they first meet an eldest, Islanzadi is very theatrical about it almost. Mm. And that's kind of how I approach each of her scenes. She's very sweeping and broad and...
That's really true. There is kind of an awareness of her presence in a scene.
Yeah.
I think from her own point of view, she's really aware of the impact that she's conveying.
And I've always thought that's one reason Arya is much quieter, actually, and much more contained, you know, that she sort of grew up around this presence and is much more withdrawn as a result.
That's interesting. Now, you also really explore politics in your books in a way that a lot of other fantasies don't necessarily. You get into the politics of the Varden, the politics of the dwarves. What made you interested?
Well, I have read fantasy books where there are lots of politics, mm-hmm. and I'm always wary of putting them in my own book just because I know from personal experience that sometimes reading politics can be boring. Really, really boring. The reason I've put in some what I have is simply because I feel it's necessary to make the world make sense. Mm-hmm. On one hand, yeah, Aragorn's powerful and he's fighting to overthrow Galbatorix, but at the other hand, people wouldn't just be handing him responsibility and favors. I mean, they are, but at the same time, they don't want to give up their own power. Same thing with Nossa Wadda. She has to fight for everything she has and everything she's going to get. And I really tried to show this in that book, especially with the Trial of the Long Knives.
That's a powerful scene.
Same thing with the dwarves, with Orc becoming king, taking the throne after Hrothgar. Because on one hand, you could say it's obvious that Orc is going to take the throne after Hrothgar dies, because Orc is the dwarf we've come to know throughout the series. He's a friend of Aragorn's. He was Hrothgar's adopted son.
It makes sense in terms of the story.
And it does make political sense as well. But I also wanted to show that he doesn't get it handed to him on a silver plate. He has to fight for it. And it makes the world more realistic, I think.
It does.
And thankfully, thanks to your red pencil,
the graphite pencil,
I don't think the politics gets too thick either.
Well, I think what's so interesting about the politics as well is that Oryk doesn't have it handed to him on a silver platter, and you really see how he's been groomed by Hrothgar out and how, where his skills lie and how he has a chance to shine in rising to that position.
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing the speech between him, or the talk between him and Aragorn under the Forest of Stone, but then also writing Oryk's speech before the clan meet when they're talking about banishing Vermund, the traitorous Grimstaborith. And I thought, again, that because we hadn't seen Oryk much in this book up until Aragorn joins him in the Beor Mountains, and I wanted to give him his due. Again, that's part of the thing with a series this big and books this big, is you really have to juggle which characters you see when and where, and try not to let too much time go by before you start forgetting a certain character.
Okay. Just a couple more questions.
Wait. About the dwarves again. I will say, I loved writing about Eärúnin, the dwarf.
Yes, you did. Woman. Yeah. And what was your inspiration for that?
Okay, don't. Well, you can laugh.
thanks for permission.
Mae West and Elizabeth Taylor.
That's fantastic. I'm sure now that people have heard that, that will really make an impression.
Well, I mean, you just never hear much about dwarf women. And I always thought it'd be nice to not only show a dwarf woman, but one who was confident of being a woman.
And she really is.
I enjoyed every single sentence about her immensely, and I would love to write, in fact, I would love to write a short story from her point of view.
Ooh, maybe that will come down the line one day.
Yes, although I'm not sure it would be entirely PG-13.
So talk to me a little bit about your languages, how you have created them, how you determine the pronunciations, how you use them in the story.
I used less of my languages in Brisinger than I did in Eldest or Aragorn, at least proportionally. There are still a lot of the languages throughout the book. And I know this just because I can look at the translation guide in the back. But proportionally, it's less. And I didn't try to do quite as ambitious things in this book. For example, I didn't do any songs or poems in the ancient language in this book. And that was partly because in Eldest, I wanted more of a sense of Aragorn going to the elves and getting exposed to their culture, and also getting exposed to the dwarves' culture as well. And this book, I was trying to focus a little bit more on just telling the story instead of revealing the world to readers. So most of the work that I did developing the languages, I did during Eldest and right after Eldest, mm-hmm. because that was where I used more of the languages than I did in, like, Aragorn. I really didn't do much with Dwarvish in Aragorn at all, for example. So the main approach I have is trying not to make them too much of a tongue twister. I try to make sure that the sound of the words is halfway decent. Of course, I'm not really great at, like, rolling my R's, which you need to do for Elvish, so I have to always approximate. But actually, more than the sound of the words, I try to make sure that they look good on the page. And, in fact, when I invented a lot of the names for Aragorn, I did it without knowing how they were pronounced.
Really?
Yeah, I did not know how to say Alagazia long after I finished the book.
Really? So how did you decide how to say it? Did you look at the structure of the different words and say, okay, it makes sense that this mm-hmm. word we pronounce this way?
In fact, that's how I started figuring out the structure of the language, is saying, okay, this is what I've done, this is how I think it would be said, and so I'm going to start basing things off those sounds in the future. And I'd done some non-standard sentence structure and stuff, so I said, okay, this is my sentence structure going forward. I did a few interesting things with sounds in this book. For example, the nomad tribes, I started giving a hint of their own language in this book. I actually worked out more of it than I actually put in the book. So what they do is, like Japanese, for example, they alternate between consonants and vowels, for the most part. You pronounce every single consonant and vowel in their language. But whenever they have a double letter, whether it's a double vowel or a double consonant, they pronounce it twice as long. So they have for example, one of the names is Inupiaq, and you hold the N sound twice, Inupiaq. I'm not a native speaker, but
you're as native as they get.
I was trying to give a little bit different feel for that language than the Dwarvish or the ancient language. And of course, we see a little bit of the Urgle language here and there. And for the look of the Urgle language and the sound, I pulled out an Aragorn translation of an Aragon foreign edition that was translated into Polish.
Oh, really?
Just because Polish, compared with English, looks so spiky.
Yeah, there are a chunky. Lot of up and down cadences.
Yeah, so I didn't copy any words from Polish, but just the look of some of the words gave me an idea of where to go.
I feel like the languages also really reflect the people. The ancient language feels like elves would speak it, just in the way the words roll off the tongue mm-hmm. and the kinds of noises that are used in the more guttural dwarvish language really feels like the dwarves, too.
Yeah, I love the dwarf language. That's my favorite of the lot, partly because it's not based on anything else. It's all my own. The ancient language is kind of an odd mix because on one hand, it alternates very flowing words like edur karthungave, which is the tailbone of the spine, with much more jagged words like garzvla or garzla, which Durza used in the beginning of Aragon. And part of that comes from the old Norse influence that informed a lot of the ancient language. Because a lot of Norse words tend to be pretty rough to our ears. In fact, all the words in English which have the sk sound, like sky or skirt,
yes.
So sk, all of those come from Norse.
Wow.
Which actually tells you how much of an influence we have when our word for sky comes from Norse. So anyway, I tend to look at all that stuff when I'm working on the languages, especially like the ancient language, saying, well, do I want to use sort of a Nordic word here? Do I want to just invent a word with a Nordic feel? Or do I want to go slightly more in a more flowing feeling? It's always a mixture. In fact, every time I hit one of these sections, they slow me down immensely because I have to think about all this different stuff.
And you think about it chronologically as you encounter it,
mm-hmm.
rather than going back to it later.
A few times in this book, I went back and put stuff in because during the writing process, I was moving so quickly. I said, okay, I'll just deal with the languages later in a few places, especially since sometimes it's not worth putting something in when you know there's a chance the scene might be cut, for example.
Right. So much happened in Brisinger, and there is still so much left to happen in
the
very last book of the cycle. Have you thought about a name for book 4 yet?
Oh, I have. I think I have a name chosen, actually. Readers who are interested in this might be able to guess the name themselves if they think about it very, very hard. The theme of the series, of course, is inheritance. Aragon is the name of the first book, which that's not really anything he inherits, but you could say that he's inheriting the mantle of the very first Aragon. Actually, what he's inheriting in that book is Saphira and Zarok. Eldest, of course, speaks about, you know, who receives the inheritance. It's Murtagh in that case, because he's the eldest member of their family, or so they think. And Brisinger, of course, he inherits a writer's sword. He's given, finally inherits or gets a writer's sword, a true writer's sword for himself.
Part of that legacy.
That's right. So the question is, what does he get, if you will, in the fourth book? And I have the answer to that, but I'm not going to tell you.
Well, that's an interesting question to leave us with. Thank you so much, Christopher,
for
having this conversation about Brisinger and about the inheritance cycle.
Yeah, it was fun.
This was fun.
This is Gerard Doyle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Brisinger, or The Seven Promises of Aragon Shadeslayer and Saphira Bjartskule, Inheritance, Book 3, by Christopher Paolini. This program was directed by Taro Meyer, producer Orly Moskowitz. This program was recorded and edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2008 by Christopher Paolini. Production copyright 2008, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.